This is the Takeout.
Ask not what your country can do for you.
With Major Garrett.
Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
At this defining moment, change has come to America.
And we will make America great again.
Welcome to the very best part of my broadcast week, hanging out with you here on the Takeout Podcast in podcast land on CBSN. Hello, CBSN viewers. I'm joined by Steve Shigaris, the political director of CBS News and the world's greatest podcast sidekick. Hello, Steve.
Good morning. Hello, Major.
Good morning. He's saying good morning because it's breakfast time here in Washington, D.C. We're at the Dubliner restaurant. We've been here many times before. We love being here. The lighting is beautiful. The food is great. And it's a great Irish pub right near Capitol Hill. And because we're near Capitol Hill, we are with Seth Moulton, a congressman from the 6th District of Massachusetts. Ladies and gentlemen, there are 98 members of the 115th Congress who are veterans, 18 in the Senate, 18 in the House of Representatives. Seth Moulton is one of them. As any Marine knows, you're never a former Marine. You're a Marine your entire life. And Seth Moulton is a Marine who deployed to Iraq several times and is a member of Congress in his second term. Seth Moulton, thank you so much for joining us here at the Takeout Podcast.
It's great to be here.
I want to ask you about the big news item this week. The president sent out a series of tweets that caught the Pentagon flat-footed, Congress flat-footed, almost everyone in the administration flat-footed, saying, if these tweets are to be believed and are going to be translated into policy, transgender Americans have no place whatsoever in the U.S. military. Your reaction?
Once again, the president is threatening our national security. He's taking steps backwards on civil rights and fundamental freedoms afforded in the Constitution. And ultimately, he's hurting our military by doing this. As Senator McCain himself said, if you have well-trained men and women out there who are ready to put their lives on the line for the country, we shouldn't take them off the line for any reason like this, just because they need medical care like anyone else.
The generals are behind this.
Well, first of all, his facts are all wrong on that. It's not too expensive. It's a tiny, tiny fraction of the military budget and even the military health care budget. But much more importantly, this is about civil rights. This is about fundamental freedoms enshrined in our Constitution. I don't frankly care how expensive it is. It's the right thing to do. It's got bipartisan support in Congress. It's about civil rights. What's more important than that?
And he also said, and Sarah Huckabee Sanders, the press secretary, said this decision was made to improve readiness and unit cohesion.
Well, it's interesting because that's the word from a president who has five deferments when the Pentagon, Senator McCain, other veterans like myself are all opposed to the president on this. So I think you got to ask who understands readiness better.
Tell our audience a little bit about your own military service.
So look, I didn't grow up expecting to go into the military. But when I got to college, I looked around and realized I hadn't really done a lot to give back. You know, a lot of people were doing more than I was. And so I wanted an opportunity to do some sort of service. I was really influenced by actually my college minister, Reverend Peter Gomes, who was quite this larger-than-life figure on campus.
Where'd you go to college?
I went to Harvard. And he was not only the campus minister, he was had one of the most popular courses there. And he talked a lot about the importance of service, about how it's not enough just to believe in service or support service. You got to go find a way yourself to give back. So I looked at different options. I looked at Peace Corps, teaching overseas. But at the end of the day, I had so much respect for these 18, 19-year-old kids who put their lives on the line for our country that I decided that that's where I wanted to do my part.
And why'd you choose the Marine Corps? The hardest of the
You know, I wish I had a good story for that. I mean, usually it's because my uncle was a Marine or whatever. I didn't have that at all. So I kind of just looked at the different options. I knew I wanted to be in the infantry. I knew that if I was signing up because I respected these 18, 19-year-old kids, I didn't want to be riding in a tank when some 18-year-old was slogging through the mud next to me. So that basically narrowed it to the Army and the Marines. And it was actually an Army lieutenant colonel who convinced me to join the Marines.
How many deployments?
I did four deployments to Iraq.
And politically, where was your head at any point during those deployments on the Iraq war in general?
You know, I voted against President Bush twice. I didn't agree with his war. I mean, at first, I just didn't really know what was going on. I was going through training while the whole debate unfolded. But I was strongly opposed to most of his policy in Iraq. But I was proud to serve. I was proud to go with the Marines I served with, and I was proud that nobody had to go in my place.
And part of your military service in Iraq led you to consider running for Congress, did it not?
Well, actually, that's not how it happened. So I got out. I came back to Boston, went to grad school, went to business school. And, you know, like any aspiring Massachusetts politician, I took a job in Dallas, Texas, and started a life down there. So, no, this was not on my radar screen. I was actually recruited by a nonprofit that's trying to get veterans to run for office. We've never had fewer veterans in Congress in our nation's history than we do today. And so they called me up when I was living in Dallas and said, hey, you should move back to your home district in Massachusetts and run for Congress. And I said, hey, you sound crazy. What are you talking about? I was a hard guy to convince.
But wasn't there an encounter, because I read this in one of the biographies about you, in Iraq, where one member of your platoon, I believe, because you were a platoon leader, said you ought to run for
platoon
Congress.
Commander in the Marines.
It's very platoon commander. The terminology is very important. I want to pay due respect to Marine Corps terminology. Platoon commander. One of those in your platoon said you ought to run for Congress so we don't have to go through this again, or some variation of that.
Yeah,
did that leave an impression on you?
Corporal Castro said that.
Meaning the Iraq War.
He was at the end of a pretty tough day in 2004, and he looked up at me. I remember where he was sitting and where we were, and he said, you know, sir, you ought to run for Congress someday so that this stuff doesn't happen again. He used a Marine term for stuff, to be specific on terminology again.
We'll leave that part of Marine Corps terminology out of the Takeout podcast.
I understand. You went home to your home district where you grew up to run for Congress.
But let me just interrupt, because to be fair, like, he didn't convince me. I mean, that, you know, I went back. I went to grad school. I moved to Dallas. I mean, clearly, this is my plan. So when this nonprofit called and said, hey, you should think about running, I thought back. I remembered what Corporal Castro said. But to be fair, he didn't convince me at the time.
But so when you decided to do this, you went home to your home district where you grew up. That was a seat that was being held by somebody who had been in Congress for
18 years
at the time. And yes, he had a little bit of trouble, but what goes through your head to try to primary a guy like that in a district where whoever wins that primary likely wins the general election because it's so Democratic? That's an uphill battle for somebody who's never been in politics. So how do you convince yourself to do that, to run against a guy who's been in office for so long?
You know, maybe if I'd been in politics, I wouldn't have taken it.
Right, exactly.
But are we going to order?
Yes. Ash is here, our fantastic waitress here at the Dubliner, and we'll get the rest of that answer. So, Ash, we had kind of a pre-conversation before the show about this, so I'd like the Irish country breakfast.
Sounds good.
With the soda bread. Thank you.
Yeah.
Mr. Shigaris.
I'm getting two eggs over easy with some bacon on the side and some toast, please.
Some white wheat rye or something?
Wheat would be perfect.
And Mr. Congressman.
Well, I'm going to go with the American breakfast. Very politically correct answer.
We have a sound effect for that.
And wheat toast, please.
Wheat, yeah?
Thank you.
So, yes, the courage of that move might have been not as informed as it possibly could have been, but you gave it a run and it worked.
Look, I just looked at this and I said, at the end of the day, Washington is never going to change if better people aren't willing to run.
But you announced 18 months before the primary, right, if I'm not mistaken? That's a long time. I mean, it wasn't clear that this was that there was an opening here. So I guess, how do you convince yourself to say this is worth my time to go home and run against an established incumbent.
Yeah,
it's a hard thing to
do,
right?
That's a good question. And to be honest, like, it did take me some time. I mean, as I said, like, they had to do some real convincing to get me to consider giving this a shot. Ultimately, I looked at two questions. Is this fundamentally a place where I can make a difference? Because I missed public service after the Marines. And second, is it a race I can win? But, you know, that's one of the things I've noticed about veterans, and this isn't just true of me. True of most of the veterans I know, is that we get out and, you know, I honestly thought I'd go in the Marines and I'd check that box. I'd do 4 years. No one could ever again question whether I'd done enough to serve the country. Instead, I got out and I really missed it. And I'd find myself sitting in a classroom back at business school, which, what a great opportunity, you know, amazing opportunity to get to go to business school. But I sometimes would be like, gosh, this is so self-serving. Like, I have no sense of purpose. Even in the middle of the Iraq War, which I strongly disagreed with, every single day, my work impacted the lives of other people. And I missed that sense of purpose in my life. And now I'm back in a job where I feel like I can truly help people every day.
Let me ask you this. What do you think, if there is, first, I guess the first question is there an approach that post 9/11 veterans bring to the work of Congress that you think is different than pre 9/11 veterans bring to Congress?
Well, I don't know about pre 9/11 versus post 9/11, but I do think that this generation of veterans, on average, is less partisan, more principled. I mean, we've had to put our lives on the line for the country, so we're more likely to put the country first over personal politics or party politics. And this is why I'm working so hard now to recruit other veterans to run.
Even Republicans?
Well, I'm not. I'm focused on
Don't
Democrats.
Go that okay, far, okay. Major. Settle down.
I was going to try. See what the limits of partisanship are. But Democrats, okay.
Yeah, I'll tell you what. If someone wants to run, my first question is not what party you are you. It's why do you want to do this? And mm-hmm. because I actually work very closely with Republican veterans, with colleagues on the other side of the aisle who are also willing to put the country first over party politics. So I've got eight veterans now that I've endorsed in tough races in 2018. These are the kind of leaders that I think people are looking for in politics today. People that you can trust regardless of what their party label is or their particular position on a certain issue.
Before we go to break, I want to ask you a question because I started covering Congress in 1990, and I got to know Bob Dole very well. I got to know Bob Kerry very well. And the one thing I will say about them, different parties, different wars, but people who have really been in it, and you know what I mean by that, don't view politics as the biggest, most titanic struggle of their life. They have a kind of distance to it that I think is born of the reality that they experienced in warfare. Do you feel that's true? Do you feel that maybe that's part of the reason there's not the partisan inclinations that are as strong among veterans?
I do. I think that's absolutely right. I mean, people ask me, I don't know what to do. This is such a tough vote. I said, just do the right thing. It's not that hard. Like, just vote the way you think you should.
There are harder things in life.
Everybody will be angry at me. Is anybody shooting at you? I mean, no. Come on.
There's the
question.
So
I think that's true. I think that, you know, look, when people ask me, Seth, gosh, what is wrong with Congress? You know, why is Congress so stupid? How can Congress not believe the facts on health care or not believe in climate change or whatever the issue of the day is? And my answer is I don't actually think most of my colleagues are stupid. I mean, maybe there are a few exceptions, look, it's hard to get elected. I have a lot of respect for my colleagues on both sides of the aisle. This is a tough job. But I think what's lacking in Congress is not intelligence. It's just courage. It's just the courage to do the right thing when you know it's the right thing, even if it might be unpopular with your party base or politics back home.
Just courage. That's the voice of Seth Moulton, the congressman from the 6th District of Massachusetts, our guest for this 28th episode of the Takeout Podcast. We are at the Dubliner Restaurant. I'm joined, as always, by the world's greatest podcast sidekick, Steve Shigaris. You are listening to and enjoying The Takeout.
The success they've had against ISIS is extraordinary. We've made more progress in the last 4 or 5 months than the previous administration made in 8 years. And then we have to see what we have to see. But I will tell you, ISIS in Syria, ISIS in Iraq, ISIS in other locations, we have made tremendous strides.
That's the voice of President Donald J. Trump, the 45th President of the United States, in the Rose Garden earlier this week in a press conference with the Lebanese Prime Minister. Seth Moulton is our guest. Congressman, you served in Iraq. The president was sort of telling the country, dig me and my ISIS strategy. We've done all these fabulous things in Iraq, and the previous administration gets no credit. Your reaction?
The president's full of...
Full of what?
Marine
stuff. We have a term in this Marine, raise the BS flag. What he said is an outright lie. Actually, the Obama administration made far more progress against ISIS. They controlled most of Iraq and Syria, and only controlled Mosul by the time that Obama was done, only controlled about half of Mosul. So Trump has half of a city to his credit, and the Obama administration has most of a country as far as pushing ISIS back.
And it's Iraqi forces who are doing most of the fighting.
That's right, with American support and advice and ammunition and weapons, but that's right. And, you know, actually what's incumbent on Trump is to figure out a way to make sure that after ISIS is defeated, we don't find ourselves with ISIS 2.0, because that's the situation we're in right now in Iraq. Where
what
it seems
do you mean
like,
by that?
So it seems like every time we go through these battles, let's not forget, there was a battle of Mosul 10 years ago. We won that battle. But then a terrorist group came into the political vacuum that we left in its wake. And so that's why my point to both administrations, and by the way, look, you can call me partisan, but I've been very critical of the Obama administration on their Iraq policy as well. So when I say that Obama has done more than Trump to defeat ISIS, I mean, that's just plain facts. I mean, that's just look at a map. But I've been critical of both administrations because I've said, look, it's not enough just to militarily defeat the terrorists. You've got to have a plan to ensure political stability, or we're going to find ourselves back there again 5 years from now fighting the next terrorist group that comes in.
When during the campaign, candidate Trump said President Obama pulled everyone out, that created a vacuum, that it left an opening for ISIS. Does he have some validity there?
Actually, there's some truth to that. But it's not about pulling out the troops. That's where Trump gets it wrong. It's about ensuring political stability. Now, sometimes troops can help, but what we really have to do is help Iraqi politics in the same way that we've been mentoring Iraqi troops. We actually built the largest U.S. embassy in the world in Baghdad because, you know what? We knew they needed the help. They did not know how to run a democratic government, and yet we then left that embassy half full. So just how, like, I was on the ground with my Marines providing mentorship to the Iraqi army, we needed to provide that mentorship to the Iraqi politicians so the country wouldn't devolve into political chaos, and that's what allowed ISIS to sweep in from Syria.
You called what the president said the other day a lie. Is he lying? Is he just wrong?
Well, the president lies all the time. I mean, the president, you know, the first press conference he gave, he couldn't even be truthful about how many people showed up to his inauguration. I mean, I think everybody knows that this is just a habit of Donald Trump. He lied in business. He lies in politics. He lied during the campaign. He lies as our commander in chief. But I'll tell you why that's a problem, because I think that we've just kind of gotten used to this new normal in America where we expect that the president will open his mouth or say something on Twitter and it probably won't be true. It's a real problem when you're the commander-in-chief, where integrity matters, where our allies and our enemies have to be able to take us at our word. When I went through training in the Marine Corps, you know, went to Quantico, you could fail a test, you could fail a run, you know, you could drop out of some physical training thing or whatever, you know, and they give you a second chance, you know. But if you lied about anything, the smallest thing, you are gone that afternoon. Gone.
Gone.
Because
out.
Integrity is the most important thing.
And trust, and people have to believe
because
in what you're
saying. Because if you're
putting
your life on the line for your country next to someone else, like, you've got to be able to trust them. If another officer says, I'm going to show up at noon to support you in this mission, like, you got to trust that he or she will be there. That's what it's about. It's about trust, and it's just a sad state of affairs that we can't trust our commander-in-chief.
You and your fellow Democrats are saying a lot of things like that about the president. Some are raising the question, is that a strategy moving forward? I'd like to play a bite from earlier this week. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer tried to lay out maybe a path forward for Democrats in terms of a message. Can we get clip 5, Katiana?
President Trump campaigned on a populist platform, talking to working people. That's why he won. But as soon as he got into office, he abandoned them, making alliance with the powerful, special interest, Koch brother-dominated, hard right wing of the Republican Party, which appeals to the very wealthy, not the working people, leaving a vacuum on economic issues. We Democrats are going to fill that vacuum. Democrats will show the country we are the party on the side of working people.
So it's taking the Trump criticism to another level and trying to tie it to economic issues, trying to tie it to policy. First of all, what was your reaction to Senator Schumer's remarks and this strategy that he's trying to unveil?
Well, I think he's right. I mean, I've been calling for the Democratic Party to be more focused on an economic strategy for a long time. because we have a lot of economic policies that help working class America, but clearly don't have a strategy that embraces them. And we've lost touch with a lot of people who were historically Democratic voters in America. And I think the point, though, is that, you know, we can talk about Trump and how he lies as a commander-in-chief, and all that's true, and it should matter to Americans. But if you want people to actually vote for you, you got to have a plan yourselves. You got to have a mission going forward. And I think that's what we've been lacking in the Democratic Party.
But a message that resonates, right? And there's some criticism about what Chuck Schumer and other Democrats laid out this week, that the message might not be easy for people to comprehend. You can point to Donald Trump and say, make America great again, and people got that as of whatever they filled in the blank on that, and it worked for him. Some people are saying what Chuck Schumer unveiled was not that. It wasn't catchy. It wasn't something that people are going to be able to embrace for the midterms. What's your reaction to that?
Look, I'm not a political pundit. I don't know about catchy messages. I just want to.
But you got to get elected.
Well, right. But I didn't run on some catchy slogan. I ran on getting people to trust me. And what I liked is when people came up to me and said, you know, I don't even necessarily agree with you on everything, but you're the kind of leader that I can trust. And by the way, that's why I've also been calling for new leadership in our party. I think it's one thing to have a new message. I think we also need new messengers. So it's time for...
What does that mean? What do you mean by that?
Specifically, well, about your current leader.
Well, look, we have... our leadership slate is elected and is there. And,
do you want them gone?
You know, look. Yes, I've been very publicly opposed to Leader Pelosi, who, by the way, is an amazing politician. I mean, she was the first woman to become Speaker of the House. And I'm never going to do that. I mean, she's really achieved an awful lot. Obamacare wouldn't exist. It saved millions of lives without Pelosi getting it through the House. Not a perfect piece of legislation, but she deserves a lot of credit for that. So. This is nothing about her personally, but there comes a time when you just need some change. And the reality is that...
Our breakfast has arrived. That's why we're pulling back from the microphones ever so slightly, because we have to make room for breakfast here at the Takeout Podcast. You know, at the Dubliner restaurant, by the way.
Looks good.
Looks spectacular. The food here is always great. So is the Republicans just run.
All they need to do is run against Pelosi. And you know what? That's not fair. It's not right. But that's reality. And so I've been calling for a new generation of leadership in the Democratic Party. And that's why I'm working so hard to recruit these veterans across the country who are almost all, you know, younger, like close to my age, but want to get in, want to provide some new leadership, some less partisan leadership, some leadership that Americans of all political stripes can believe in, even if they don't agree with us.
Could you be one of those new leaders?
Well,
whether
actually,
it's in the House or for something else, perhaps?
No, so I've actually said I'm not going to run for anything. I'm not going to run for a leadership position. I think it was important for someone to come out and say, I'm doing this because I think it's the right thing for our country and for our party, not because I think it's the right thing for me.
So let me just put this in very stark terms. You head into the 2018 midterms. You want this leadership team to be the bumper sticker for the Democratic House minority or not?
No, I don't.
You'd like to see the leadership changed before the 2018 elections?
I think we're going to have a much better chance of winning if it does. And that's the bottom line. You know, when Americans
are
losing...
So how does that happen? There's going to have to be a pretty significant uprising in the House Democratic caucus to make that happen.
Well, that's right. But I think it's the right thing to do. I mean, when Americans are losing their health care because we can't hold the Republicans accountable, when Donald Trump is running roughshod over our national security and putting the nation at risk because we can't hold him accountable in the House of Representatives, what we've got to do, not just for our party, but I think for so many American people, is start winning again. Start bringing some balance back to Washington and start winning with leadership that the American people can trust. Not the old, tired, Democratic partisan leadership, but really a new generation of leaders.
And this current leadership, elected by the House Democratic Caucus, is an impediment to that.
Look, I just think it's time for a change, Major. I think it's time for a change. And when I go home to Massachusetts, you know, old Democrats and young Democrats alike say, you know, keep fighting, Seth, because we just need some change. And many of them love Leader Pelosi. You know, I came to Washington. I wanted one thing. I wanted to be on the Armed Services Committee. She got me that committee assignment. She's been great to me. But I just don't think it's the right thing right now for the party.
That is the voice of Seth Moulton, Congressman from the 6th District of Massachusetts. I have some of my breakfast.
How's that banger?
My scrambled eggs here.
Excellent. Very good. We're at the Dubliner restaurant. You are listening to, and I'm enjoying my breakfast here at the Takeout.
You are listening to The Takeout.
And digging every single moment of it. I'm Major Garrett. You know, new episodes of this outstanding podcast known as The Takeout are available every Friday morning, just to remind you of that. And we most earnestly invite you to subscribe, rate, if you will, and comment on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google, and we're so happy to say Spotify. Go to takeoutpodcast.com. And really, this would be cool. Follow us and like us on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter at Takeout Podcast. That's at Takeout Podcast. We know you don't hate the show. I'm not even going to do that hate the show thing because we know you love the show. These are Takeout Podcast stickers. They are the biggest sensation in the land of podcast living. Okay? Signed by yours truly, Major Garrett. You can receive them one way and one way only. Congressman, I think you'll appreciate this old school methodology we have employed here at the Takeout Podcast. Steve Shigaris, world's greatest podcast sidekick, tell our wonderful viewers and our cherished listeners just exactly how they can obtain said sticker.
As you know, Major, there's only one way to do this. If you'd like your very own Takeout Podcast stickers signed by Major, send your request along with a self-addressed stamped envelope to Takeout Sticker, care of CBS News at 2020 M Street Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20036.
Who is Gino DeFabio? I ask you, who is Gino DeFabio? I'm going to tell you. And Congressman, you should probably get to know a little bit about Gino DeFabio, because he's central to the problem you just described, losing touch with Democratic voters. Gino DeFabio was with the president earlier this week in Ohio, a lifetime Democrat who said this when the president brought him up on stage.
Gino, get over here, Gino. Whoa. Gino DeFabio.
You know, anybody who knows me, friends of mine, people who love me, it's worse for them. But they know how it's been since President Trump started running for the election. How much I supported this guy, how much I love this guy. I said, this guy's got something. He's the real deal. Look what you could do in the bastion of the Democratic Party. I don't think there's anybody except Cuyahoga County that's more Democratic voters than us. Look what you could draw.
Big crowd. It was in Youngstown, Vienna, Ohio, the general area that the president was in. Went strongly for him during the election. This seems to be central at the core of your party's problem in the Trump era. How do you
address
it?
We've got to come to terms with the fact that we've lost. We've lost a lot, not just the presidency, but the Senate, the House, state legislatures across the country, governorships. We've got to look ourselves in the mirror as Democrats and say, we're losing. We've got to make some changes. We've got to listen more to the American people. So I think Gino is going to be pretty disappointed when he sees what President Trump actually does. I saw an article yesterday about how the Carrier plant. Remember when he went to Indiana and made this big deal about bringing jobs back to the Carrier plant? It was just a sweetheart handout from Pence to this Indiana plant, and Carrier's now started laying people off and sending those jobs to Mexico, including, they mentioned, a bunch of the people who had supported Trump. So this is going to start coming home and hitting home, the fact that the president hasn't done anything to improve infrastructure. He hasn't done a single jobs bill. He hasn't fulfilled any of his promises, and that's the stuff we should be talking about right now. How do we get people back to work? That's the stuff I want to talk about as a Democrat. Those are the things that we ought to be talking about as a party.
Congressman, reality check for you. Dean Reynolds, my distinguished colleague for CBS News, talked to Gino DeFabio the next day and said all the things you just said. You know what he said? Give him time. Give him time. We're still with him.
Okay. We'll give him time. We'll give him time. But I'm just saying, I don't know when it is, but at some point Gino's going to be pretty disappointed in this president, because the reality is
isn't?
That...
What if he isn't?
Well, if he isn't, then maybe that'll be good for America.
What if this is a cultural turning point in the country?
What I'm saying is that, you know, if Trump actually fulfills his promises and brings jobs back and improves health care, makes it less expensive and better like he promised in the campaign, then that's great. The health care bill he's been pushing will strip health care away from millions of Americans. He promised a big infrastructure bill. We haven't seen it. He promised to improve our national security. He's doing a whole lot of things to make it weaker, to make it worse. That's why General Mattis is, came on as Secretary of Defense and has been so publicly opposed to many of his policies. So look, if Trump actually came through on his promises, then you know, good for him. But what I'm saying is that when he's not, rather than just complain about it, which is what Democrats have been doing a lot, we ought to have a new plan ourselves. We ought to go out to America and say, you know, I know a lot of people are losing jobs. I know a lot of people are still trying to get out of the economic recession that started under President Bush. They really haven't been a part of this recovery. I know that a lot of people are losing their jobs, not just to immigrants or to trade, but to robots. You know, jobs are being automated out of existence. How do we deal with this new economic reality? What's our plan going forward? By the way, Trump's plan is we're going to go get pickaxes and go back into the coal mines. You know, that's what he wants to do. That's how he thinks we're going to bring jobs back to America. I think even the coal miners know that that's not true. That's not going to work. But I think that everybody in America, whether, you know, whether you live in Illinois or you live in Silicon Valley, you need to be a part of this new economy, and we need some leadership to get us there.
Speaking of Democrats voting for Republicans, there's an interesting dynamic going on up in the Bay State. You have a Republican governor who is the most popular governor in the country. You said you were not going to run against him. That's correct. That still stands.
That's right.
What is he doing? First of all, do you support him in his reelection? Secondly, well, it's an interesting question. He is the most popular governor in the country, That's a Republican fine. In a very Democratic state. A lot of Democrats in Massachusetts support him. Do you support him? Secondly, what is he doing right in Massachusetts that maybe Republicans around the country could take lessons from him?
Well, one thing he's doing right is he's standing up to the president, although I don't think he's doing it enough. He's come out publicly opposed to the president's health care plan, but I think that he should use his leverage as the most popular, not just the most popular Republican, but the most popular governor, Democrat, or Republican mm-hmm. in the entire country to actually change the president's opinion. You know, I don't think he's actually been down here to Washington to go and really hold it to President Trump and say, you're killing my state. You're killing a lot of people across the country with this health care plan. So I think Governor Baker could be doing more. But one lesson he should take is he's not just caving to these extremist far-right Republican Party politics that seem to be dominating the scene these days. He's willing to take his own positions. He's willing to be independent. And we need to see more of that kind of leadership in the party.
So how do you play in a governor's race next year? You have a Democrat who's going to be up against a pretty tough Republican opponent. Do you get fully behind the Democrat? Do you support Charlie Baker in anything that he's doing as a Republican?
You know, honestly, look, Governor Baker and I have worked together on a lot of things, so I'm not afraid to work with Republicans when our interests align, and that means down here in Washington. It means up in Massachusetts as well. I haven't endorsed anyone in the race. I haven't thought about it. I'm focused on the real threat to the country right now, which is Donald Trump. And, you know, when some Democrats came to me and they said, you know, we wish you'd run against Governor Baker, I said, look, Governor Baker is not a threat to the United States of America right now. I believe our president is. Our president is trampling on our Constitution. So if I can be down here in Washington and doing my small part as a member of the House of Representatives sitting on the Armed Services Committee to keep our country safe from this president, that's what I'm going to focus on.
Do you see yourself ever going up against this president, perhaps in 2020?
You mean running against him?
Yeah, talk about that.
I'm not running for president, but I'm gonna
definitely. You're not currently running for president. Could you be running for president in a few years?
I'm not running for president, but I go up against Trump every single day. I hold him accountable every single day, and I try to speak truth to power. I think that's what Americans want these days, is they want some people who are willing to be honest and speak the truth. And by the way, you know what that also means? It also means agreeing with the president if I agree with him. Think about that.
Has that happened yet?
Well, I'll give you an example, and this comes back to what we were talking about with recruiting veterans to run. I started a group called the Warrior Caucus of combat veterans from the most recent wars together with a very conservative Republican from Oklahoma, Steve Russell, but a fellow combat veteran from Iraq. Now, Steve is someone that I disagree with a lot on very important issues. There are some fundamental issues in politics where he and I are in very different positions. But we try to focus on the places where we agree, and we agree a lot on national security policy. And so when the president shot the Tomahawks into Syria in response to Assad's chemical weapon attack, he was the first person to call me, texted me, and he said, you know, we ought to get a joint statement out about this. And what a great testament to our new caucus if we can be the first to have a bipartisan statement on the president's attack. And so in about 20 minutes, we had a bipartisan statement. It said, we support what the president did to hold Assad accountable, but if he wants to do anything more in Syria, he's got to come before Congress. pretty simple, straightforward, but it was a bipartisan statement. You know, sadly, it turned out that our rush wasn't really necessary, because I think it's the only bipartisan statement today to date on that attack. But it's an example of where two veterans on different sides of the aisle were able to come together and both hold the president accountable if he wanted to actually get us further drawn into war, but also give him credit where credit was due for holding Assad accountable.
So, Congressman, a good number of our audience members are Trump supporters. And you just said he's a threat to the Constitution. They would say, no, North Korea is the biggest threat the American government faces right now, regardless if you're Republican or Democrat. Would you agree with that? And what do you think we ought to do about it?
No, I agree with the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, who's nonpartisan, and he said Russia is the greatest threat to the country. I think that's actually the greatest threat, because not only do they have thousands of nuclear-tipped missiles aimed right at us that, by the way, are proven to be able to reach us, unlike North Korea's, although North Korea is dangerously moving quickly in that direction. Absolutely working on it. And we've got to counter that threat. You know, who knows? They might have a few dozen someday. Let's be honest. Russia has had thousands for the last 50 years. They are the greatest threat to America physically, and they are the greatest threat to our democracy, because they're trying to undermine the integrity of our elections. And this is a place where Democrats and Republicans have got to put party politics aside. Every American intelligence agency has come out and said that Russia meddled in our election with the purpose of electing Donald Trump. Fine. But you know what? They might choose a Democrat next time. And so Democrats and Republicans have got to come together to stop this. And then when we get to the bottom of it and we make sure Russia never does this again, we can start talking about the things that really matter right now to American people, like getting those jobs back, like improving our infrastructure, like figuring out how we deal with this new economy and all the new challenges that it brings. Those are the things we should be focused on. But the problem is the president is trying to, you know, derail this Russia investigation.
And before we let you go for this segment of the Takeout podcast, the House and Senate have, by overwhelming bipartisan majorities, passed sanctions legislation against Iran, Russia, and North Korea. Russia was really the center of this debate, though.
Right.
What is Congress telling the president with this particular action?
The Congress is telling the president that he's wrong on Russia, that trying to cozy up to Putin, who would love nothing more than to see the United States wither and die, is wrong. And even despite all the Republicans in Congress who just seem to support Trump wherever he turns, they're getting the courage now to speak out and say, nope, we're not going to let you get away with this one because it's harmful to our national security.
And a veto would be overridden instantly.
Yeah, based on the numbers we see today, absolutely.
That's the voice of Seth Moulton, Congressman from the 6th District of Massachusetts. He has been our guest for the 28th episode of the Takeout Podcast, which, if you look at your calendar this morning, it's the 28th day of July. I'll let you make of that synchronicity what you will. Steve Shigaris, the world's greatest podcast sidekick, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Major.
I was a little hesitant.
Thanks, Major.
There you go. All right. Congressman Moulton, thanks for joining us.
Pleasure. Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to and digging on The Takeout.
The Takeout is produced by Arden Farhi, Katiana Krachenko, and CBS Radio News. Follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, and visit takeoutpodcast.com for more information.
Never quit, never give up. Always do what you love. Take great care of your family and your parents, because we love your parents. You probably wouldn't be here without your parents, right?